Our topic this morning is story or substance. And Terrence McNally, Chipper Lay, and James Trengrove, welcome and happy to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And we have a fourth person in the room. Hello.
Hi. I'm just the producer.
Okay.
the driver.
But feel free to jump right in.
Right. Well, we're happy to put you on the mic and invite you to jump right in as you will. And I'm Kathy Partridge, your host this morning, regular Connections Friday morning host, pleased to be moderating this on-air panel for the Conference on World Affairs. And we are a call-in show and welcome participation by phone from our listeners at 303-442-4242. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in and doing a panel this way. I hope you've been having a great time here in Boulder this week, and look forward to hearing what you think and what you have to say this morning. So our topic is story or substance. Is political communication story or substance? Seems particularly relevant in this political era coming out as we did from the 2008 campaign, where story was so much a part of how the campaigns were run. The Sarah Palin story, the Barack Obama story. But let's talk about this.
McCain, even though we'd been around forever, the convention was about the McCain story.
The stories. And so let me just put this out here and ask each of you to react from your perspectives, your backgrounds. Don't we really need fact in politics? Don't we really need to know the truth? And isn't story just a smokescreen to Chipper Lay. Chipper Lay, please start, and we'll hear from everybody. Chipper Lay is a senior analyst at the Political Research Associates up by Boston, and a wonderful bio. Maybe we'll read bios later, but I'm eager to hear from you all. Chipper Lay,
well,
answer my question. Is the story is just a smokescreen?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Stories are the way most people learn about the world. And here's the trick. I once interviewed this guy, Edward L., God knows, in the 20s, wrote the book on propaganda, selling commercial.
And he is the grandson, the grandnephew of Sigmund Freud?
Yeah, exactly, a little sidelight. And he said, look, there's propaganda and there's impropaganda. And he, you know, he's 80. At that time, he could get away with those lines. But essentially, it's like if the story is focusing you stuff that is demonstrably, you know, you can replicate the information by doing research. What's wrong with that? If the story is a lie, then it's a lie. And what we know in terms of building social movements, I'm a faux sociologist, you know, that essentially in every social movement, you need a story to keep people involved and to motivate them. And so, you know, sociologists talk about ideology, frames, narratives, and in that web of interaction, you get information to people that really pulls them into a project, and from there are being recruited into a social movement.
Well, Chipper Lay, I'm going to follow up in a minute with you on that, because I know that a lot of your study is of fascist and neo-fascist movements, and it seems to me that story is a scary concept in that realm. But let's just kind of go down the line here. Terrence McNally, I'm not surprised that you're a fan of stories. I'm a fan of Julie Brown. And back in the day when I hosted a program here at KGNU called Feminist Frequencies, we regularly played and loved Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun.
And I like them big and stupid, which is absolutely
a favorite,
the
yeah.
flip around.
Real
in
dumb.
Which they were the boy toys, exactly.
Absolutely. And so given that, no wonder you work with nonprofits and progressive businesses to get their narrative straight. But what about my question? Isn't this just a smokescreen to obscure facts and realities?
If it is used as a smokescreen to obscure facts and realities, it's the most effective thing to use. But if you're using it to good purposes, it is likewise the most effective thing to use. I think it's a false choice, story versus substance. Story with substance is what you want, and that is where we should be advocating. And anybody who thinks that you can't do both together probably isn't good at story or substance or both. because if you think about the 2004 campaign, which was one, I mean, you're right that they were a big deal this year. But I think if you look back at the 2004 campaign, that the negative story, which is something that we haven't mentioned yet, but the negative story is really powerful. And in that one, the Republicans, Karl Rove, et cetera, did such a good job with their narrative, their narrative of John Kerry, that all you had to do was hear the word Massachusetts, right? Just one word, and you got the whole story. Rich, out of touch, not like me.
Latte drinkers.
Exactly.
Prius drivers.
And now, and I'm going to tell people that when you're listening to this show also, if you are a nonprofit, a foundation, someone with a cause, or a corporation, listen, because this stuff is not just about politics. It's what works. And what you do is you want all your individual stories to link up with that big narrative. And then people, it's almost like Velcro. People hear a word, they hear a phrase, they see a quote, they begin to be able to put it into the narrative that you've developed.
Great. And James Trengrove down here in the corner.
Please
in the
call
studio.
Me Jim.
Jim, good
mm-hmm.
morning, Jim.
Good morning.
And your work has been more in what we might call the news media itself.
Yeah, I would call it the news media itself,
and,
yes.
And what role does story even have in a news broadcast orientation? You covered the presidential debates, wrote about that, mm-hmm. did a piece on that was nominated for an Emmy.
Mm-hmm.
What about story in political reporting?
I think story is very important, especially from our point of view. I worked at the NewsHour for 21 years covering Congress and then later in charge of all our political coverage. And, you know, Jim Lehrer has always said that, you know, we dare to be boring on the NewsHour. And to which Ted Koppel said not too long ago, they're a little too daring. So, But you know, we do a lot of substance, but, story is the way we hook them in. And, of course, we would do a lot of studio discussions, but we also did, and I covered hundreds of campaigns over the last 20-something years, and a story is the way to hook the viewers in. And so whether you're going to a town or you're going to an event or you're tying it to a person, I always like to develop a story first and take it from the beginning and most often try to come back to the beginning at the end of the story. And in the middle, you stick in the substance. And so there's a narrative that you can follow and you plug in the facts along the way.
Well, narrative is sometimes used as a larger frame. Frame is another term. There's a whole way that we are now talking about story, frame, narrative, the George Lakoff stuff. We've had Lakoff a number of times here on KGNU, including this program, Connections. The narrative has not been set by the current administration yet. I just put that out on the table to react to. Is this still the Reagan narrative, the Republican narrative, the Bush narrative? Terrence McNally, you're giving me a face here, which our listeners can't see.
Right, right.
But react to that, please.
No, I just thought that was – I certainly don't think it's the Reagan narrative. I think what we're – I think – I will agree. I don't think we've settled on this narrative, but I think that – This particular narrative is a meeting of two narratives, or maybe even three. One is the Barack Obama narrative, which I think the larger narrative is his story, his biography, that he is young, that he is new, that he represents change. But what I think that campaign told even more so was a consistent narrative about the United States, that we... Our political process, our political arguments and so on had paralyzed us. We'd gotten afraid of asking the big questions and had gotten kind of, I think, the narrative that was going, which you're right, does fit with the Reagan narrative. The Reagan narrative would be government is the problem, drown it in a bathtub and so on. The narrative which I think had come across, that Obama was putting out is we've gotten to where we accept the fact that we can't solve big problems. And there's a way of doing business in Washington and in the media that supports that. Then you match that with the narrative of we are in deep doo-doo, which I think is the
technical term.
It's
yes.
the technical term for the situation we're in. And so if you say that old way didn't work and we're in big trouble, then my way, my new way, people coming together, reaching out to Iran, having a Seder in the White House, being bipartisan, even when we know that we won't get a single vote. I think it's beginning to form. You've got my way of solving these huge problems.
And you know, narrative is not a magic wand. Framing is not a magic wand. And my criticism of Lakoff is that he has, you know, two-thirds of a good theory. What he's missing is that narrative and framing have to carry substance. And it has to be built around a coherent ideology, and there have to be resources then to implement the plan. People have to be taken someplace, and there has to be some institutionalized, you know, structure to take their excitement and turn it into mobilization, and from mobilization to recruitment. So I think the Democrats, who God knows, you know, I'm a confessed Democrat, because I think, you know, that already you're seeing in Washington the centrists trying to yank toward in their direction and yank the Democrats to the middle, and they're now talking about they have a story now. Here's a narrative that's a lie, that progressives in the Democratic Party are for the first time meeting with conservative evangelicals. Well, that's absurd. I mean, progressive people of faith and conservative people of faith have been meeting for decades. What's the outcome of this? Okay, because there's no ideology behind this very, very opportunistic move. Well, they want to try and get more evangelicals to vote Democratic. So what are they giving up? Well, it turns out that instead of the Democratic Party platform, which was reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies, they are going to reach out to these conservative evangelicals with this story of cooperation and give them what they wanted all along, which is making the narrative about ending abortion, stopping abortion, reducing abortion. It's a bad thing. We should stop it. So they're selling out women and gay people on a lot of levels on gender issues out of a bizarre search for conservative evangelicals, when it's the centrist, it's the middle-of-the-road evangelicals who are the swing voters. So here's an example of a narrative being used to sell a retreat on human rights in order to gain votes. And I think that's despicable.
But from the perspective of the centrist, perhaps, why are the progressives so hung up on these terms? Why if the ultimate result is that a woman can get funding for low-income women could get funding for reproductive care and abortion and the day after pill as part of the package, and everybody says we want to reduce abortions are bad, what's the problem with that?
Well, not everyone says abortions are bad. A lot of women's groups think they're a good thing for a lot of women. Secondly, the deal here is that once, and this is where Lakoff is right, once you take their frame as your frame, you've lost. And their frame is ending abortions. And ending abortion switches the focus from human rights for women to a medical procedure that's ugly and must stop. And
but
so
I'm a
they've
woman
already
who
lost.
Needs an abortion and don't particularly care what the right or the left have to say about it. I just want to be sure I have access to that policy. If the Obama administration can get policies through.
My guess is that woman is not the one that we're worried about being affected by this tactic. In other words, that woman, you know, fine. But what any tactic in any sort of branding, any sort of messaging, if we were talking about a product or a political campaign or a political movement, is about all the people who respond to the communications you're putting out, even though they're not in need. And they're beginning to create their narrative built up of all these little pieces. And that's where I think Chip's pointing out your unnecessarily, when you adopt the opposition's frame, you're sort of playing in no man's land. If you were in tennis, for instance, you know, you're where you can't be, you know, you can only defend yourself.
So the story in this case is the substance. The story needs to be a woman's right to choose.
I think that as long as the frame is about rights and choices, even though the ultimate result for that woman who wants the abortion is the same, I think that's the turf you want to be playing on, yeah.
Absolutely.
And, well, let's move in. Jim, your work focuses more on foreign affairs. You live in Azerbaijan.
I was in Azerbaijan for 3 months there.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back a little bit about narratives because I did cover Congress for 21 years and talk about the Republican Party at this point that has no narrative. And probably isn't really searching very hard right now for a narrative. You know, they're at an all-time low as far as their approval rating, and I think right now they're just trying to keep their powder dry and try to figure out what the Democrats and what President Obama's narrative is going to be before they go ahead and develop their own. I mean, they would probably like to get something together before the 2010 elections. I think they will.
But well, they had a narrative which they tried hard to push, the individual, the morality is sin, the welfare recipients were sinners, the rest of the globe are sinners, the government drowned in a bathtub. They had their narrative pretty intact and pretty broadly defined.
Right, but they also had George Bush as the president, as the predecessor for the party there, so he didn't do John McCain much good. So I don't think the narrative would have worked in any case, no matter what the narrative was at that point. Obama, and especially if you're looking at his approval ratings now in the first 100 days, I think we're now at day 83 or so, something like that. The first 100 days is also always based looking back at the predecessor. So if you look at George W. Bush's first 100 days, it was in reflection of Bill Clinton. If you look at Bill Clinton, it was in reflection of George the First. So, again, it's going to take them a while to develop a narrative. And, again, I don't think they're in much of a hurry.
But I would say, sorry, Chip. Okay. What I was going to say is that one of the things that I mentioned when I first spoke about the painting of a negative narrative, the painting of the narrative about the other, I think actually if you look at this, the under the Reagan years, there was the development of the Republican narrative. But in subsequent years, very much there was just that narrative carried over, and what they thrived on was defining their opposition. I call them electoral savants in that they were only good at defining an opponent, demonizing them, winning elections, and had no impulse or inclination to govern. So I think they are working right now on their negative narrative. That's what all the socialism talk was about. Mm-hmm. And they've, let me just say, outside of the narrative, I think the strategy, and I'm not the only person to say this, is that they're basically selling short. They know that they can get no credit if things work out. If the economy perks up, they get no credit even if they vote with him. So basically, even though my guess is there are individual congressmen who would like to see things happen, their thing is no, 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 because it's the only strategy for which later they can say, we told you so. And so that's their side of the negative definition. And thus, if you're going to vote against everything, you want to define everything the other side does as negative. Socialism. And also, suddenly, they're against deficits. You know, when they ran up the largest ones in history.
Yeah, and so when people ask the president or the administration, are you surprised that the budget that just passed got no Republican votes? Well, of course not. I mean, it never gets Republican votes from. I mean, basically, it's a blueprint anyway. You're right, Terry. It does no good for them to vote for it.
But part of the administration's narrative is reaching out in a bipartisan way, and then they're slapped back. And the fault of that is a Republican, and they're just totally innocently surprised, right?
And the funny thing is they keep doing it because, hey, if they're gonna keep reinforcing this thing that they're obstructionist and they insert Rush Limbaugh, wants us to fail. Rush Limbaugh, no votes on the budget equals they're the same.
Right.
This is a great strategy, and if you see, if the Republicans are taking the strategy they want and telling the story they want, they're playing right in this case to the Democrats doing exactly what you just said. I'll keep reaching out. You'll keep slapping me back. I'll keep looking good. You'll keep looking bad. If it all fails, you pick up the pieces. If it succeeds at all, we win.
Right, and here's the problem for the Republican Party. They have two competing narratives, two competing frames, and it is the Grover Norquist, drown the government in the bathtub, versus the Sarah Palin, you know, God tells me to save the world. And here's the bad news. The Republicans, you know, it would be easier to sell a laissez-faire kind of libertarian, independent, we're all just folks kind of policy, except their single largest mobilizable voting bloc is the Christian right. Now, that's only about 15% of the voters telling, you know, folks that when they leave the polls that we're part of the Christian right. There's 30% are evangelicals in general. So here's the question. Can you deep six the Christian right when they consistently turn out? And they turned out, the same 15% has turned out since 1980. That almost doesn't change at all. The swing voters are the moderates. So the Republicans are setting up the Democrats for the same trap. They're courting the conservatives And the Republicans are saying, you go right ahead and court the conservatives, because every time you meet with them, you're compromising in their direction. You're using their frame. And meanwhile, the Republicans are focusing on the moderate evangelicals who the Democrats should be focusing on. So it's an idiotic kind of contest that's going on for the hearts and minds of moderate evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. Well, but are the evangelicals even still the story at this point?
To Chip, they are.
Yes, to me they are.
To Chip they are. Chip Earley, say more.
Well, there's a lot of them. Let's start with that.
And Colorado, we're quite aware of that,
yes,
in fact.
Yes, Colorado Springs, ground zero, as we like to call it. But, you know...
By the way, don't eat a meal in Colorado Springs, because they've reduced the government so small they can no longer... inspect restaurants or daycare centers or swimming pools.
So you should pack a lunch and take it with you.
Pack a lunch. Okay. Yeah, buy the lunch up here in Boulder
Go tour, focus on the family. Right.
There you go.
And also figure you're closer to your own end times that way.
Yeah, that's true. Bring it on. You know, if you look at the voting patterns, there was a lot of coverage after this most recent election about how Obama had done so well with evangelicals in general and Christian conservative evangelicals. And that's true compared to Kerry, but Kerry was an atrocious candidate. If you plot the last 8 presidential elections and look at the evangelical voting patterns, all Obama did was go back to the norm. So there is a big battle for the evangelicals. Not as many evangelicals switched to the Democratic Party as you would have expected. And so there's something very much in motion here. But these are highly motivated people who are much higher in terms of their voter turnout and have a very easy network. It's called church, and they get together on Sunday every week. It's an advanced person's dream, right? You know, any political campaign can really flourish when you know where your base is going to be one day a week.
I think the inroads that President Obama has is in international affairs with the evangelicals, yes, in promoting going after poverty, going after AIDS, as President Bush did. Give him some credit for that as well. But these sort of social issues that go across borders, I think that's where the inroads could be.
And a big issue, again, for the evangelical community, both the progressives and the conservatives. I want to let our listeners know the program is Connections. I'm your host this morning, Kathy Partridge, and very pleased to be co-sponsoring this panel this morning with the Conference on World Affairs, the 61st Annual Conference on World Affairs. And my guests this morning, a panel I'm proud to host, of Chip Earley, Terrence McNally, and Jim Trengrove. And our topic is political communication, story or substance. We are a call-in program and invite your participation here on Connections at 303-442-4242. Please call and join in the conversation with your questions, your views, and your comments. Like to let you know you're listening to KGNU Boulder, 88.5 FM, KGNU Denver, 1390 AM, 93.7 FM in Nederland, and KGNU.org. We've been talking a lot about the Republicans and their use of frames, but let's reflect a bit on the 2008 election. I know in your own ways each of you were connected and involved, of course, in that campaign. Was that really mostly a battle of story, or was it a substantial difference that the voters latched onto in selecting President Obama? Terrence McNally?
Well, let me, if I may, take just a little bit step back. You mentioned at the top that I actually counsel foundations and nonprofits and some corporations and so on messaging and story. And what I've come to learn over the years is that while story has a unique power, as I say, for most of our history on this planet, that is how the tribe knew what it needed to survive. That's how the stuff was passed down. But what I've come to learn is that what your most potent package is a compelling story, a powerful piece of data, and a call to action. And when I look at the Obama campaign, they did that very, very well. They had the large narrative, as I mentioned, which was one was his own narrative. I'm kind of the new America.
I am America, yeah.
I embody every piece of the... And I'm a new generation, and I'm part of the world, and I am ready to do things different. I'm different, and I can do things different. And then, as I said, the frame about the U.S., that we had gotten ourselves into a logjam. Now, in terms of data, well, whatever the issue was, if the issue was education, if the issue was healthcare, if the issue was foreign policy, he's smart enough that he'd have that thing that says this is not just story. But what he did really, really well, besides this thing of matching all the little stories to that those bigger narratives, was calls to action. And if you think about it, you know, we got, if you got a message from Obama, the big message you got was the one of yes, we can. Do not accept that we cannot solve our problems. Yes, we can. And then the call to action, join us.
Well, the
friend us. forward this message, contribute money, gather together in house meetings, volunteer, and ultimately vote.
And tell your story. The Camp Obama trained folks that ran around. I mean, here we, you know, as a swing state, we saw a lot of action here. It was all about the story of the voter. And when you went door to door, that was, you were supposed to take a little time. What is the story of this person that you're asking to vote?
They actually framed it that way.
Sure, they did.
So that they weren't just saying, "What? Here's our story. Here's the big story." They said, "You want to know the story of who you're talking to?"
Mm-hmm.
And but always linked to a call to action.
Always linked to a call to action, and this idea: I'm not bringing change to Washington. You are. That resonated with people, didn't it?
Yep.
And this program is clearly resonating with our callers, and we have some folks eager to join us. So, Mike, you're on Connections.
Oh, hi. Great program. You guys always do a great job. I like to listen to Connections every week.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Basically, this sort of goes to real fundamental philosophical issues of perspective that you really can't get out of your own story in a sense. I mean, the idea of an absolute objective truth, you know, I don't mean to be overly, you know, esoteric about it, but yeah, it's got to be framed. And I think the most salient point that the panel just made is that as soon as one buys into the way that the opposition or the other person, whether they're opposition or not, has framed the issue, boy, you're in, and you're in over your head. So it's just, do you really think that that there's any way out of, I mean, this sort of implies that there is just, you know, one factual recounting of things. I don't know. These things are interesting, and I'm just going to get off the line and listen to you guys. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call, Mike. Anyone want to run with that?
I think one of the whole points of the Conference on World Affairs is that there are multiple valid stories, multiple valid ideologies, and that, you know, democracy depends on the kind of interaction where people can judge who has a better analysis, where are we going, and who's going to get us there the best way, where should we go. All of these things are in contention constantly in a democracy, and so stories that help bring that out, this fusion, this amazing thing that we have in this country about being able to talk about things, actually helps build the basis of a democratic civil society. If we focus in the news media on gossip rather than, you know, even entertainment, but just pure gossip, gossip is displacing the kinds of ideas and stories that democracy needs. And that's terrible. And, you know, and you can make interesting shows out of, you know, subjects of policy. So, and I want to throw in the idea of remembering that Irving Goffman came up with the idea of framing, not because he was interested in packaging ideas, but he was saying all of us live in the frame we have created for ourselves. And that idea is then taken out to be manipulated by conscious, you know, effect. But the fact is, we all have our own frames. We all have our own stories. And that doesn't mean we're manipulated when people reach out to us on that basis, unless we're just, you know, we need to be more skeptical. That's all.
And I would say,
Terrence,
it's funny, when you got to the skeptical line, as I was listening to Chip, what I was going to say is just, I think one of the things that a listener should take from this is that we are ourselves swimming in stories, and the you know, the fish doesn't see water because they're swimming in it. I think the thing you want to learn is to be looking for the story and then be looking for the substance in that story and kind of constantly doing kind of a check of, am I just sailing along, you know, caught up in some story that someone's told, or am I checking constantly to see whether this actually has this, whether this actually resonates for me on a real substantive level.
Yeah, let me just add that it was frustrating for me covering the primary campaigns of so much story and, to me, so little substance. And having done this since covering the campaign since Mike Dukakis and George Bush, that I said enough and I quit my job. because at the NewsHour, you deal in substance, you deal in facts.
Right,
and
right.
Again, the stories for us, and it's different for whatever program or media you're looking at. You know, we're dealing with substance and facts and beyond the story. And from my perspective, we weren't getting enough of that. With candidate Barack Obama, I thought he was very good at identifying the problem, rallying the troops. And the tagline was always, we're going to fix it. And it was, all right, well, how, you know? And I think it caught up to him a little bit, and Hillary Clinton started to make some inroads coming back.
Well, it certainly wasn't, when it got down to just two candidates.
When it got down to two candidates. And it was too late because she had missed all the caucus states. But at that point, I had to start going looking for some substance, and so I quit my job and ended up in Azerbaijan. Which they have a lot of substance. They have oil and gas and Russia and Iran and Georgia and Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh. So that was something I could sink my teeth into. So.
Well, and the administration now is certainly running into substance and an unprecedented, you know, depression, Afghanistan, the Korean missile, et cetera. So the substance is always there, catching up behind the story.
I would say, by the way, that what we see is the story that they told, which a lot was a story of process. We're going to approach things differently.
Different, yeah.
I think if you look at what's consistent now and what we've even been talking about is this approach. But could you say that there is a consistent, the approach of how we're going to look at things, but is there handling of the economy? You know, will it stand up to a strict analysis of whether it adds up? I don't necessarily think so.
Yeah, we're not sure yet. Let's welcome Max, our caller, to the conversation. Max, you're on Connections.
Hey, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed listening to you guys. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
So this is perhaps a dusty perspective, but you guys have a classicist on the air right now. And I cannot help but see massive parallels between the storytelling project of Obama and that of young Octavian, who would later be Augustus. Octavian inherited a country that was racked by war, torn apart by these internal strifes, and the sorts of ideologies and terms that had once united the Roman people had been so overused and so stretched out, just like freedom and liberty had been overused and stretched beyond any sort of real meaning anymore. And so he had to inject new meaning. And just like Obama sort of did, Augustus took his new agenda, his new ideas, and sort of deftly wove them back into Roman history, just like Obama is deftly sort of weaving his ideas back into the history of America and saying, no, this is the American story. This is what we've been doing all along. And it was amazing to me when I watched Augustus and read about Augustus and saw how really, truly he changed Rome dramatically and yet simultaneously made them think and made them seem to believe that nothing was changing, that they were actually returning to a value that had been lost. And I would love to hear you guys' interpretation of that.
Well, there's a theory called palingenesis, which says that countries go through a process of falling apart and that at any given moment there is a call for heroic rebirth, which is just what palingenesis means. And there's good news and bad news about palingenetic social and political movements. The good news is that, just like you say, they say we're going to actually restore the past glory of our society, but overwhelmingly they actually create a new society entirely. But in doing that, they are actually saying we're recreating the old. And they produce a successful new society. If the frame for a palingenetic movement is we're all in this together, that's great. If the frame is the Jews own all the banks, the Muslims are all terrorists, the homosexuals are out to, you know, steal our children, then you have a totalitarian movement brewing, and that is, in fact, what was the frame in Nazi Germany. So, yes, it's like populism can be very, very good or very, very bad, and it really depends on whether this project of rebirth is everybody, you know, go watch Hitchcock's movie Lifeboat for direction on, you know, what you do and what you don't do when you're all in the boat together. You know, you don't even throw the Nazi overboard. It's a great movie. But if you turn it into scapegoating, there are devastating results for the society.
Well, I've known David Axelrod since 1980 and known of his work since we worked in Chicago, and he was a Chicago Tribune reporter. And he certainly is a student of history, but if I see him, I'll ask him about Augustus. I haven't heard him mention it yet, but I think it's a very good theory.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing the rest of you guys talk.
Great. Thank you, Max, for, I think, a provocative comment. Really, the kind of comment we expect from our KGNU listeners. Our guests here are, of course, flabbergasted, but KGNU is a listener-supported, listener-member-volunteer-driven radio station, really does have great conversations, and it makes it a joy to do the Connections program. We're coordinated today with the Conference on World Affairs. This is a shared panel with CWA participants Chip Burleigh, Terrence McNally, and Jim Trengrove. And our topic is story and substance in political dialogue. We also have Pam, who's been waiting quite a while to join us in conversation. And Pam, let's welcome you on the air. Pam, you're on Connections.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate the conversation. My question is, given your comment that Republicans are struggling to find their story, I guess my question is, the debate has been moved so far to the right that in terms of Obama's first 100 days, what it has yielded as compared to what was anticipated, and the difference in terms of the different handling of, for example, the bank bailouts versus the bailout of the auto industry. Do we really even need Republicans anymore? Don't we have basically a corporatist state that continues to appease the elites? And I'll get off for the answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
McNally.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I referred to before, saying that he has been consistent to the story about we will reach out and we're in this together and so on. But if you took away all the talk and all the enthusiasm and just looked strictly at the actions and didn't know who took them, I think it's what she said, that particularly the difference in the way that they've related to bank CEOs and the banking industry and the way, especially the investment banking industry, and the way that they've responded to the auto industry. If you didn't know, you'd swear that it was the Republicans in charge. I think this is the place where I said I think they are finding their way. And here's the thing. I noticed that when we talk amongst ourselves, we also develop our own narratives of what's going on. And one of the things that I have found myself believing is that as much as Obama painted himself and paints himself as an outsider to the Beltway, to Washington and so on, it feels to me like the people who he is listening to, the people he is gathering around him to deal with the financial crisis, are all within the same worldview bubble. That they are you know, bankologists, as Arianna Huffington said in the Post a couple of days ago, they are bank centric, and it is even with the best of intentions, if that's all you see, if you see things the way the person, you know, Geithner, Summers, all of them seem to, and why is there no Stiglitz? Why is there no Krugman? Why is Anne Bourne not brought back in? And that, I think, is a dangerous thing, because with the best of intentions, if you analyze the world wrong, nobody wins.
And this is a big game. I mean, I just got some quarterly statements, and you know, I've got a puppy in the fight here, and so, as do all of us.
How many trillions will we end if this latest bank bailout doesn't work, it comes back for another trillion and say, okay, I'll try something else? I don't know.
And this is where the populism, the danger of either a right wing populism, a left wing pop, there's stuff that could happen here. Jim Turngrove.
Well, I was just going to say the progressive movement, it really has concerns what's happening here. And the financial crisis really has dictated the narrative for Obama. And so in a sense, they're making it up as they go along, as quickly as they can. If you saw the Frontline documentary that was on back in February on the meltdown of the financial crisis, which was a very dramatic timeline, beginning with Bear Stearns and carrying it right through, and an interview with Senate Banking Chairman Christopher Dodd on this very historic, famous, dramatic meeting in the Speaker's office on September 18th, where Treasury Secretary Paulson came in and said, the global financial system will collapse within days if we don't act now. And Dodd said, you know, the oxygen just left the room. And he said it was as bad as 9/11. He said, I'm not kidding. He said it was that serious. And so when you see how quickly they have to make decisions, it's hard for them to, you know, form a policy or even a narrative to take them through this.
But as we said, remember all the talk about Team of Rivals when he was putting together his cabinet? You know, and that was kind of a clever definition of a rival, someone who was a Republican or Hillary who was an opponent in the race. But a real team of rivals is that you set up differences of opinion, you set up different perspectives, and thus you, as he said, I will be the one that sets the vision.
Right.
You make decisions, but I don't think there's enough range of voices right. and perspectives in their handling of what I think is the biggest problem.
And
we
it
face.
Almost feels like he's trying to get this one out of the way. You know, he's doing that team of rivals thing around health care and, you know, pulling in all the various parties and so forth, not quite
well,
enough.
Wait,
single payer.
You know that single payer, I think that was another demonstration of the same thing. Single payer was not going to be at the table until there were massive. Now, see, he does listen. We will say that. That's that thing of when his website and so on get this amazing influx of people saying, wait a minute. And finally, there were two or three, counting Conyers and Sanders. But there again, he was willing, if there hadn't been a protest, he was willing to stack an entire summit without anyone who favored single payer.
A lesson to progressives who want to stay at the table is that you got to get in there to be at the table. I want to back up just a little bit on this point, though, because Chipperley, you were really reacting very much to the idea of the risk of populism. And I want you to say, I know your research on fascism, neo-fascism, the Nazis, and so forth. Have we got something to fear here with this bank crisis?
We have a great opportunity and a potential terrible outcome. You sure? Of course we do. Populism is a rhetorical style. Okay, it is not an ideology, and there's a bunch of really good books out on this. And so populism is the idea that there are these elites that are not doing the right job for the people, the middle class. And if in fact the leadership of the nation says, "All right, you know, We're going to have to solve this. We're all in this together." Like I said before, it works. But what are the stories that pull people towards right-wing populism? Well, that there's secret elites up above and lazy, sinful, and subversive parasites down below. So there are parasites above. They're picking your pocket for the bank, the banksters, the corporatists. And down below are the lazy, subversive, sinful people. And, you know, we should throw them all off welfare and start putting electric fences on the border to keep those Mexicans out. And God knows every mosque is a hotbed of terrorist training. And so this kind of story can really take off. And it's really marginal people who get whacked by middle-class people who are terrified of being squeezed from above and below. And that's actually called producerism, that we're the heroic producers in the middle, but those lazy people up above and down below are robbing us blind. And that can be focused towards violence. And even when people don't urge violence, if you demonize and stereotype whole groups of people as being responsible for the collapse of the ideal society, then you get violence just coming out of that, because especially young men, somewhat uncivilized, I raised a son. I mean, there is a point when teenage boys say to themselves, well, if they're the problem, why isn't anybody acting? And they go out at night and
they act on it.
They beat up people.
Yeah.
Right. They beat up gay people. They throw firebombs into black families' houses. And that's the dynamic.
And let's take a caller on that note. Caller, you're on the air. Are you on Connections? Hello?
Am I the caller?
Yes, you are. I'm sorry, I didn't have your name.
Okay. This is a good segue. I was just watching a clip of Glenn Beck online, and it seems to me that there's a lot of the right, including in mainstream media, that's coming close to calling for insurrection, and it's people sort of treat it as a joke, but it's extremely, in my opinion, quite scary, and it seems to become actually part of the Republican Party line. and how they're trying to frame their narrative. It doesn't seem like a long-term electoral winner, but it's extremely worrying and doesn't seem to be getting the attention it deserves as a real threat. And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Good question. Who'd like to?
Well, two things. As Chip was talking about populism and how populism can carry different messages, I was thinking of Glenn Beck, and I was thinking of, I think there's an uptick in people going postal. I mean, it does seem that every second or third day. Now, it turns out some of them have been in other countries, but it seems like, I mean, it's I get mixed up. You know, wait, was that Binghamton or was that, you know, there's been so many. So
there has been. It has, in fact, been substantially a rash of mass shootings.
Now we know, you know, that has to do with guns. It has to do with a depression. But I think there is something. And as we know, the Sarah Palin rallies had some of this thing. And you know, just the notion that I think the pundits began to talk about the pitchforks. Mm-hmm. You know, well, pitchforks might have been fine in Frankenstein, pitchforks and torches, but I think it's guns nowadays. I think it is dangerous. Now, I think one question was, how does it – he said he doesn't think it's an electoral strategy. I think I remembered what I said before, which is that you are speaking to some people who are actually going to act on what you say, but to others, you just want to keep them energized. So if you let this kind of you know – irrational, violent thing, be out there in the culture. Some people will act on it, but some people will just feel they care.
I think we should watch what happens over the next couple of months on how maybe the narrative that we're all talking about now changes with the war in Afghanistan, and that becomes the hot topic. And when the bodies start coming home, because going from 50,000 to 122,000 troops in Afghanistan and a surge into the south, and now they're going to be able to see the caskets with the flags, which we weren't able to see during the Bush administration. That's going to dictate a change, I'm sure.
Oh, we have
Is that number you just said? I hadn't heard that number.
Well, it's going to be total of NATO and U.S. forces, about 122,000. But
Wow. The peace movement's been nervous about that since before the election, and actually some of the votes for Obama were peace votes. Let's welcome Paul to the conversation. Paul, you're on Connections. Paul?
Good morning. I'm really enjoying your conversation. I want to ask about the theme of the Great Turning. There are a number of messages in our society that say that we can pull all of this together and kind of save ourselves if we're willing to do the Great Turning, as described by the book The Great Turning by David Corton and some of the deep ecology work of Joanna Macy. Can you ask your guests to comment on these themes and how we can multiply this message of positive activism?
Well, I mean, you need to. I would explore a larger range than just the work of Corton, because I'm a little suspicious of a kind of utopianism and a kind of a lack of rigor in the writing of Corton. I know he means well. I certainly agree with a lot of what he says, but you know, there is no magic wand. There is no great turning that's going to happen. You don't have tipping points that usually go well in a society. If a society comes to a tipping point, it usually tips down the canyon and rolls around in the thorns. So. Yes, we need
that's
as a work.
Negative point of view. How about the positive point of view?
The positive
precisely
point of view?
Precisely my point.
Well, I'm saying that Corton is not. I don't think he has sold me on the idea that we're about to have this. I think absolutely we need to change our energy consumption. We need to change the way we do economics and monetary and fiscal policy. We need to really look at, you know, how corporations work, but a lot of these arguments confuse the word corporation with the word corporatism, and assume that when you talk about corporations and corporatism, you're talking about the same thing, and you're not. Corporatism was a vertical syndicalist theory put forward by the Catholic Church to stop the communists in Italy. It has nothing to do with corporations that sell you know, stuff like at Walmart. And the famous quote that gets kicked around in these circles that, you know, that fascism might as well be called corporations because it's a form of corporatism. That's a hoax quote. That Mussolini never said that. So let's be clear that corporations play not a very good role a lot of times. There are some good corporations. But to argue that what we're facing is either deep ecology or fascism is simply not accurate.
However, one of the things I am sort of I'm an optimist. Okay, that if, as with an alcoholic or a corporation or anything you look at, it's when you hit bottom that you are willing to change. When I have my optimistic moments, I say that we have crashed so badly in terms of, you know, wars for false reasons and the Wall Street crash and some, that the person who was blithely going along through the Clinton years and maybe the start of the Bush years and thinking, I don't have to think about these things. I'll accept things on face value. My life's going fine. I think that at this moment, this is my hope, that people will actually be awake, that the percentage of people awake and asking questions will change, and that maybe some fundamental changes are possible. One of the things that I hope is that the war on drugs, which has been accepted without a rationale, really, strictly on emotion, the empirical, you know, data just is completely against it. I'd say the same thing about single payer, that these are two things, to end the war on drugs, to adopt single payer, are things which were off the table as long as people weren't thinking at all. But now that many of the things we took for granted have been exposed as frauds, perhaps people are open. And if I were a progressive, I would push and push and push for that story.
Those two particular things. Let's turn to Samden. Samden, you're on the air.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
My question's a little different than what's been happening, but the same thing that's going on here. What I'm concerned of is whether or not we'll come up with a better decision-making process, especially at the legislative level. Obama's opened up and tried to, or at least said he'd create a lot more transparency. It seems to me, especially with the war on drugs, okay, we decided to have a war on drugs. It seems to me what you just said is we just decided. We didn't go through this process to make a decision. Science has a process to arrive at information. Do you see any change in that or see any hope that something like that would make it so that we didn't have to go to rock bottom to make better decisions and choices?
Well, unfortunately, it always takes a crisis to move along.
Jim Trengrove?
Yeah, and I think we're certainly moving one one of the panels I was on this week, we talked about the crisis of the energy, the crisis we're coming through with oil having peaked, climate change increasing at a pace more dramatic than scientists previously thought. That tied in with the economic bubble, which may not have popped all the way, that we're going to have to be making some decisions quite soon, maybe in there's doomsday theories that take it down to 2030 or even 2020. And again, 2020 is hindsight, which is Congress always looks at its inaction and bad decisions that way. So unfortunately.
I would suggest, by the way, a couple of books around these themes. One is when you said it takes a crisis and so on, Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, you know, points out that Milton Friedman says when a crisis hits, it depends on what ideas are lying around. So anybody who wants to sort of look at how it is now that the Democrats are in charge when there is a crisis and want to see where that goes, you might look at Shock Doctrine to analyze it. The other thing is, in terms of someone who has predicated a turning to these crises with a lot of facts, is Lester Brown in Plan B, and it's up to Plan B 3.0. This is primarily on the environmental realm, but if the environmental realm, which means jobs, which means all those, which means energy, which means climate change, if that were to shift and be mobilized, it could answer a lot of sins.
We've just got about a minute left here on the Connections program, this concurrent panel with a conference on world affairs, and our topic has been substance and story and politics. And I think that we've covered some of both and like to give you each just a very brief opportunity. And we do just have seconds apiece. What's the soundbite, the final story here to wrap us up and send you back up to the CU campus for your next event? Chipper Lay,
The story of progressive social change is that social movements push political movements, not the other way around, and we got to kick some butt.
How can people be in touch with you if they're interested in following up on your work?
We have a website, publiceye.org, Political Research Associates.
Terrific. Okay, Terrence McNally, how about you?
How to get in touch with me would be the website, terrencemcnally.net, in which they can find access to all the podcasts of my radio show on the Pacifica Station in L.A., which go back years and include a lot of people we've talked about. I'd say that this, I realize now, as the election was going on, the story I kept telling was that FDR came to office in 1932 as a moderate. And it was only because the people held his feet to the fire. There were the unions, of course, were powerful then. The farmers were angry and in trouble. People went to Washington. People camped out. People, he said it. He said, if you hold my feet to the fire, I mean, not those words exactly, but then things will move in the direction you want. And I just say that is what I would say to listeners.
Thank you, Terrence McNally. And Jim Trengrove, how about you? Final word on our panel.
Well, if you
today.
Want to get in touch with me, call Chip or Terry because
he's in Azerbaijan.
My Azerbaijan email doesn't work anymore. One thing I want to say is, you know, the energy that I've taken from the audience at the CWA this week, a lot of interest in seeing what is happening, and an interest in them looking at themselves and redefining themselves, and individually, but also as a whole. And what we've talked about today, movements ahead and positive movements, I took a lot of that from this week.